Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to go to the second of the two lectures, or two classes, two sets of exercises on writing, and we were right about two-thirds of the way through the discussion of motivation. The assignment was a talk on the virtue of justice to college freshmen. Prepare the outline of a three-minute statement to motivate your audience. And we had just got started with the idea that you want a personal example that will strike them where they live and involve their interest. And we gave the example of if your teacher were unjust and distributed your grades to someone who needed it rather than you who deserved it, and how you would immediately react, that's unfair, that's unjust, I earned it. And if the boss then said, well, he needs it, you don't, you're being selfish, justice is selfish, what is your response? It looks like you certainly have a right to justice, and yet the other person is maintaining something comes above justice, which is people in need, and you've all heard that one too, and now the two come in conflict. So what do you do and where do you stand? That's a good beginning. I wouldn't spend more time than that on it, but it's just enough to perk up their mind that there's something here that I don't know, that I, the student, don't know, that involves my life. I know I'm counting on justice and fairness, and somehow he's subverted it, and I can't say what's wrong with it, and so it becomes a puzzle. Now, Mr. Gerald Hunsicker, who is seated right there, very bravely came up and said that assuming that much, he would give us another 2 minutes of motivation and no more than that added on to this. So you can sit or stand, read, whatever you want, just to fill out that motivation a bit more.
I'm going to start as if you are the class and students. During the next 3 hours, we will be discussing the virtue of justice. The question is, who cares? Specifically, why should you care? A few days ago, I got a speeding ticket. I thought that was unjust. I assume that some of you have gotten speeding tickets when others were speeding, but you were identified. Yet I was singled out. In my case, I believe the law was unjustly applied. I believe it was just a way of extorting money from you. Has that ever happened to you? Have you ever felt frustrated and angry about an injustice that you suffered, yet you couldn't do anything about it? A while ago, I was called into the dean's office. Here's what happened. One of your fellow students did some work below the level I would expect from you and your peers. I rejected it. She appealed to the dean. The dean directed me to reverse my decision and accept her work because it was the best that she could do. His argument was based on her race and gender being disadvantaged. I protested that that was not just. It was not just for me, not for you, not for the other students, and not even for her. I did not prevail. My options now are to be dismissed from the faculty, resign, or accept her substandard work. I need your help. Here are my questions for you. What would you do in my place? Who is entitled to what and why? Whose need is greater? Does that even matter? If I resign, is that just for me, for my wife, my children, my creditors? Is it just to serve a greater good by keeping my position and doing the best I can? Is my accepting her substandard work fair to you? Why? Why not? In the next few hours, we will discuss these questions. We will discover a rational view of the virtue of selfishness, define it, see its application in your life, and see if justice is applied by others in our college and our culture. Let's get started.
Mr. Hunsicker, how many years have you been teaching?
Almost 20, Doctor.
Almost 20. Well, you are certainly a professional teacher, and with a motivation like that, you've got your audience entirely hooked. That is definitely a better motivation than the one I prepared, and I'm glad that you did it, because it shows you the virtues of a really good intro, a motivating intro. Now, don't you agree that if you listen to that, you would be completely hooked? First of all, he talks directly to you. There's nothing rhetorical about it. He looks right at you, and in the vernacular, he says, "Who cares?" Which is exactly a student reaction. Any student coming into any class, their automatic reaction is, "Who cares?" So, if you can articulate that, if you can articulate that and speak for them as you're developing your motivation and say, "Of course, this is garbage, right?" "No, it isn't, because you yourself say such and such," and the student thinks, "That's right. I'm caught in my own contradiction." That is one crucial way of doing it. Now, his examples were also better, more realistic. He hit on nerves. I made my examples extreme. I'm going to take away the A's and give them to the C's. And that had the virtue of being clear, but it does leave in the audience mind the residual idea, well, that's all theoretical, nobody would really do that. If you can get a real concrete example that is actually applicable, such as, we're going to reverse her grade because of race and gender, and she's been disadvantaged, that hits them where they live, and at the very same time is an absolute out-of-the-newspapers example of injustice. And then the question that he puts to them is, but is this just to her on the basis of what she's gone through in the past? Don't we have to make up for past injustices? But this is an injustice. So what is justice? Now, they're right there on that basis alone. He's given them a conundrum, a question they don't know the answer to. They see that they have conflicting views. They see that it's urgent, that they have emotions and practical concerns that depend upon what justice is, that they're conflicted in two opposite ways. They can't escape the question, and they've got to do something about it. And then he looks at them and says, "I need your help." Well, that's just perfect to enlist them to start saying, "Now, well, what do you think justice is?" One theory is justice is so-and-so. No, and everyone will say, no, because of this case. One theory, well, what do you think it is? And then you slowly start. And of course, you have your own lecture structured. So this is just the motivation is all we're talking about. Your motivation has to lead into your lecture. If your lecture is starting with a definition of justice, then you want your motive to get them involved in what is justice. If your lecture is starting with the topic, well, we know in a general way what justice is, but is it good or bad? Is it selfish or unselfish? Then you want examples that will clue in that question. It entirely depends where you are going. You want your intro to be like starting up the motor and pointing in the right direction. So it's no good to get them all interested in justice and then back up and say, well, now we're going to take a little break and go into the pyramid of ability, because when we finish that, you'll understand justice. You kill your own motivation then. Motivation is like getting up momentum. You've got to get it in the right direction, you've got to reach them, and then go right away with it into your topic. Now, that was a truly excellent motivation, and I want to compliment. There are many, many, many people who have taught for 20 years that I happen to have heard, and in fact in my younger years suffered under, who could not articulate one-tenth as good a motivation if they even tried. And of course, a corollary of having your position on tenure is you're there anyway, nobody can fire you, you don't give a good goddamn, so you just wander in and say, "Today we're doing justice," if you even get that far. Because the way they usually do it is, Miss Smith, what do you feel like talking about today? You read Bishop Berkeley. What sort of grabbed you? You know, and then they go from there. Oh, you're not interested in that? Well, we don't have to talk about that. And that's class. You know, the idea of, we have a topic, it has a structure, and I'm going to get you excited in it fast and then plunge into it. Is this out of the question? So you've got a terrific a terrific demonstration right there. Now, just to finish what mine was, which was not, as I say, as good as that, but I'm glad because I want you to see that these answers of mine are not to be memorized. These are just a part of a method of doing it, and there's many, many options. But I just, if you look at on that sheet in number 5, motivation, the first thing to notice is that I always use abbreviations for written speech. Because the idea is to try to make it look like you're not reading. Now, actually, you're reading, but if you just stand up before an audience and say, my point about justice is that you lose your audience. So what you try to do is just put a few phrases, like I say, personal example of injustice, salary, grades. Well, I've given that already. And that will clue in what I'm going to say, and that'll lead to the problem, just need versus justice. But that makes justice something selfish, opposing to need. Now, then I thought to go on, let's make the problem even worse. Now, you don't want to get it so bad that the student gives up at the very beginning. But suppose I went on and said, gee, now I'm really confused because we've got the example that if you want the grade you're entitled to and you don't care about the needy, you're selfish. So justice is obviously then something selfish. On the other hand, people talk all the time about what they call social justice. And social justice seems to be exactly the opposite of what we're calling justice. Because social justice is supposed to be redistributing income, taking from the rich, giving from the poor. And we're told that that's true justice that we need the government to enforce. And that it's unfair to have glaring inequalities of wealth. It's unjust. So now what? Where are we? It's just to get the grade you deserve, and that's selfish. But it's just to give it to the other person, equalize everybody, get rid of unfairnesses and inequalities. So that is justice. It's the opposite policy, and that's unselfish. So exactly where are we? Does everybody in this room believe in justice? Is it yes? Which justice? Both justices, but they're opposite to each other. Now, are you going to take the view you want it to be the selfish justice when you're the recipient and somebody else to be unselfish when they're the donor? No, you don't want to say that. Well, then the question becomes, and here is where I tie it up. I wouldn't want to make it any more complicated than that, because one step more complicated and they throw up their hands and say it can't be solved, it's philosophy. People have talked about it for generations, why should I be expected to solve it? So you just want to get a defined puzzle, a defined enigma, something that hooks into their curiosity, and then broaden it to the question. So I put entitled to and how no. In other words, that's my key to say. What are you entitled to? Justice is what a person is entitled to. Are you entitled to your grade? If you're poor, are you entitled to a subsidy? What is anybody entitled to? What does he have coming to him in the name of justice? And how do you know? It can't just be what you hear on TV and on the radio. They must have heard it from somewhere. So the even harder question, what are you entitled to? And how do you know? And then the wrap up. In other words, this is what the end of my motivation to give them the outstanding question that's going to dominate the session. What is justice? What is J? Is it good? Is it necessary? See, we've already raised the question, well, there's so many different views, maybe it isn't even right somehow, so we've got to be sure we know, is it good? Is it necessary? Why? Now, do you know what NB is? Nota bene, I use it as an abbreviation for important. Why is it important? I have all kinds of these abbreviations so that I can look down at the script, grab a point, and look back up. Whereas if I have to read important, I have to keep my eyes down on the paper for 3 beats. And this way I just look down, I grab NB, and I translate it into important. So you can work out your own shorthand code. But the idea is, what is justice is the question that emerges from our preliminary motivation. Is it important? Is it necessary? Why is it you all have some view on these questions, even if conflicting views. There's obviously something about this you can't escape. You may as well, therefore, make sense of it. Let's start. Now, you see, you can do that in 3 minutes. And you can do that with a cold class, and you have to expand it to 5 if you're going to have interaction. Now, interaction is a good thing. It helps to motivate them. When they find that they can say something and the ceiling doesn't fall down, you know, people all still look at them as though they're human, their clothes didn't fall off, etc. They get more involved, more active, more interested. So it's good to have class participation. Also, you will find if your class is completely out of sync with you, you think you're talking about justice and someone says, well, in my opinion, Cyrano de Bergerac is better than Mona Vana. You say, well, why did you think of that now? And then you try to find out how did he get there from justice. But if the whole class says yes, yes, you know you're in trouble. You've got to start over again. So it's good to get some feedback, but the danger with feedback is that they give you the wrong feedback, and by the time you get their confusion straightened out and get the class back on track, you're hopelessly lost. So the solution to that is to try to get a couple of bright-looking faces and prompt them with what you want them to say. And then when they say it, you get the advantage that they say it without slowing you down. Now these are all, we could have a whole, easily a whole class or a whole course on how to have effective motivations. And in fact, in the OGC course that I gave last spring, all the different students had to present a class on some philosophic topic as though to a beginning class and start with a motivation. And we all took a pig-headed view that we're not interested, we couldn't care less, and it's up to you to motivate us. And they had 3 or 4 minutes because they only had so many minutes to do the whole thing. And I think they will testify to you that it takes a lot of ingenuity to come up against a dead class, look them in the eye, and motivate them, and then plunge right in. So there's a great deal to be said. All I wanted to do today in this preliminary thing is, if you're doing any speaking, don't forget this topic. Always remember you must say something to engage your audience's interest. Maybe you only have 1 minute. Maybe you've got the incredible luxury of 10 minutes if it's a whole semester. But if you just simply walk in and say, my topic is so-and-so, and plunge into it, you are doing your audience tremendous harm. They have nothing to attach what you're saying to. They don't really care about it. And the consequence is, even if they retain what you're saying, it does not stand in their mind as something important. And you want an ideal lecturer should leave his words in your mind as though they're written in italics. This is important. This is something special. This I don't want to forget. And you cannot do it, however dynamically you speak, without your motivation being solid to begin with. So that's so much by way of motivating you to do a motivation. Now let's go to number 4, which is context. I'm not doing these in any order because I'm saving number 1, for which I have a couple of volunteers for the end. Now, context is very related to structure. By context here, I mean this. If you're not stating an axiom, if you're stating something farther down the chain, and almost everything you write is way down the chain, you got to plunge in somewhere. Your piece, your article, your letter, whatever, has to just boldly make a statement where you begin. That, of course, will be related to structure in the sense of that's your starting point. That's the primary or the preliminary, the basis from which you're going to go on. And what I did to isolate that is give you all of an argument or a letter minus the opening statement. The opening statement would have to be the one that the whole rest of number four depends on. And you notice I put a therefore right away. I said therefore in the first sentence, it follows that, etc. All of these sentences follow one from the other if I could get it started. But if I just walk in to the room and I say to a regular, reasonable audience, if I start my letter like this, the right to life includes the right to dispose of one's life, and it does not apply to an embryo or fetus. It follows that, etc. You won't get anywhere because say, why would you say so? You're just making as an axiom. The right to life includes suicide and justifies abortion. And those are incredibly controversial. If you just start a letter like that, the people that agree with you will agree, but the ones that don't will just say, you know, that's ridiculous. So you need something that will set the context for what's coming. It'll be the basis, it'll help to explain, it'll be the thing that people can accept at face value. Even if they don't, they'll be able to see the logic of your whole argument. Obviously, you can't start with man has a nature, he must act in accordance with his nature, life is the standard as proved by. You can't give the whole context. But there is a way in one sentence of giving a logical base to this, and in such a way that an ordinary rational person would see it as a self-contained logical statement. It also happens, if you give the right opening statement, to be an assault on religion, which ties in very nicely to the rest of the piece. Now, let me get my answer here. Who has got a suggestion? This is one sentence that's going to be read in conjunction with the following that will give a logical basis for it, and at the same time can be taken as self-contained so that we don't raise more questions than we answer. Who has got a suggestion? It's one sentence. I've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 19 words, but it's only one line of type because it's all little words. Now, who wants to give me an opening sentence that we could use for this? Did anybody do this? Oh, I didn't assign this. All right, take a minute right now and write down one sentence that you could say from scratch and that would lead into this. Now, that's very unfair because it took me 15 minutes to figure it out. But take a minute. Now, I have to get on because I want, if possible, to have a few minutes at the end to answer your questions about writing. And at the rate we're going, we're just going to barely finish the exercises. So let me give you just a bit of a hint. This paragraph, as it continues, talks about the right to life includes this and doesn't apply there, and so on. So what do you think the opening sentence is going to have to do? What is it going to have to talk about in some terms?
Rights.
The rights, rights in general, or more specifically, the right to life. We don't need to talk about the right to property, for instance, or whatever. On the face of it, we have to say something about the right to life that will tell us why it includes the right to dispose of your life and why it doesn't apply to an embryo or fetus. Now, who's got a sentence about the right to life that would mediate that and give us our open? Oh, just try, even if it's no good. All right, at the back, yeah.
Well, the United States Constitution guarantees men's right to life, liberty.
No, sir, that is not acceptable. The United States Constitution guarantees the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, or whatever, is not a good opening here. Number one, we're talking philosophy, not history. We're not saying some document advocated this. We're saying this is the case. And number two, we're taking for granted that there is a right to life. The whole, and we don't have to establish that in this article. Precisely because the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence establishes that, you don't have to say, my big revelation in setting my context is there is a right to life. You want to tell us something about the right to life, which is not stated here, and which is such that when we hear it, we say, aha, yeah, that's true. Oh, and now I see why the rest of this follows. So simply to say there's a right to life doesn't do it. It's got to be the right to life is, and it has to tell us something about what the right to life is in such a way that'll open the door for the rest of this argument. Jason, now say it loud.
The right to life is the right of a person not to be stopped in the process of sustaining his life.
All right, let's try that. The right to life, well, we'll just put down right to life, is the right of a person not to be stopped. What did you say, in the act of sustaining his life?
Yeah.
Now you're on the track there. There's just two things I would want to make more accurate, but you've got the idea. The right to life is the right, I abbreviate just, I mean, my spelling. I know how to spell right, but is the right of a person not to be stopped in the act of sustaining his life. Well, if we take that literally, and we're doing this for the general public, and we say the right to life therefore includes the right to dispose of one's life. Well, all you said is that the right is not to be stopped in sustaining his life. But what about if he wants to get rid of his life? Can you stop him then? You didn't tell us about that. So we want to suggest a wide open context of action. The right to life has to include somehow the ability to act, da-da-da-da-da-da, in such a way that the people will recognize, yes, that's what it is, but not so narrowly as it includes only those actions that sustain your life, because then it's a paradox to go in your next sentence to therefore we've got the right to kill ourselves. That's one problem. So we want to broaden this formulation for purposes of this letter. This is certainly true, but we want to broaden it to say something that is true about the right to life and yet pave the way for suicide. So we want to broaden this formulation for purposes of this letter. This is certainly true, but we want to broaden it to say something that is true about the right to life and yet pave the way for suicide. The other thing you say is the right of a person. Now you put person in to cover what? The fetus and the embryo, right? And your instinct is correct. If you just said it's the right not to be stopped, then people would say, well, then you shouldn't stop the fetus or embryo also. But by putting in the right of a person, you are implicitly saying what? This does not apply to a fetus or embryo because they're not a person. That is medium okay. But the trouble with it put that way, I mean, your motive is right, but the trouble with it put that way is that the more zealous opponents of abortion will come back and say, it is a person, it's a little person. So you want to see, you've got the exact idea here, we just have to correct it in two ways. We want a definition of what the right belongs to that excludes a fetus, but that is obvious so that it's not contestable. And then we want to be able to formulate the action in such a way that it's not restricted to sustaining your life, but it's whatever action this type of entity chooses. And then you'll have a perfect beginning for this. Now you see how you do it. This is what you have to do to get your basis. Now who can think of the right to life is the right of a what? Give us something that was what Jason had in mind by person, but is even more unequivocally exclusive of a fetus or an embryo, and yet it's a word with a positive ring that everyone who hears would say, yes, that's exactly what it means to have a right. If you have a right, you are?
A rational being.
A what?
A rational being.
An individual, a rational, but I want to say something in here to suggest, remember, I have to not only say that it's not an embryo, I want to say it's a person that can do unlimited action according to his, I'm trying not to say it. There is a word. Now, let me put it to you in this way. Well, who else has got an idea? I'm thinking of a word that starts with S.
Self-sustaining.
What?
Self-sustaining.
No. Self-sustaining is going to involve us in the same problem. It's true, but it's not a good statement for the context of this letter.
Sovereign?
Sovereign is exactly the word. Now, sovereign is used as a major term in political philosophy. The sovereign is the one who has the ultimate power, the ultimate authority. When you say the individual is sovereign, you mean nothing can infringe his rights, nothing can interfere with his rights, nothing can dictate his rights. He is the ultimate independent unit. And this is a word that in an American context rings positively. It does not ring as, you know, he's greedy. It rings as this is what an American is, a sovereign entity. And of course, sovereign means completely independent, not needing others, not depending on others, not taking orders from others. So the first thing I would say is the right to life is the right of a sovereign entity. Now, no one will deny that, because if you're not sovereign, then you're subordinate to something else, and if you're subordinate, then you don't have rights, you have permissions of the person you're subordinate to. Now, the right of a sovereign entity to what? Do I say the right of a sovereign entity to sustain his life? No, because that'll kill the suicide part. So what do we say? If he's sovereign, then what is he entitled to do by the very fact that he is sovereign?
Act
how? Exactly. He's entitled the right of a sovereign entity to act in accordance with his own judgment. So my opening sentence would be, this is what I wrote, man's right to life is the right of a sovereign entity to act in accordance with his own judgment. You'll get this handed out in a little while. But now you see, if you read that on, right in man, I'll say it again, man's right to life is the right of a sovereign entity to act in accordance with his own judgment. Now read right into the next one. The right to life, therefore, includes the right to dispose of one's life. Why? You are a sovereign and can act according to your judgment. And your judgment is no one can interfere with. If it's your judgment then to dispose of your life, that is implicit in the fact that you're a sovereign entity who can act according to your judgment. And it doesn't apply to an embryo or a fetus. Why? What is the obvious thing about an embryo or a fetus? They are not sovereign. They're physically attached to, parasitically, not in a moral sense, dependent on the body of the mother. Therefore, whatever you call them, person, the image of God, etc., the one thing you can't call them is a sovereign entity. And yet that's the very thing that you have to be to have a right. That's what it is to have a right, to be sovereign in a certain sphere. So it reads right in, and it follows that contrary to the tenets of religion, man's rights include suicide and abortion, etc. Now you see why this proposition that man's right is the right of a sovereign entity is fundamentally unreligious. It is not the way religious people approach the topic of rights. Why not? Raise your hand because I can't hear you. Yes.
Because human beings are not sovereign, they're only...
Subordinates, yes. According to religion, who is sovereign? Upstairs. The rest of us are dependents, subordinates. We take commandments, our fate is set for us, and the so-called rights, our God-given rights, are permissions that he gives and that his agents can revoke, as they always do in any theocracy. So the very act of saying that man is a sovereign entity is the best way to present the issue of rights, to distinguish yourself from religion, and at the same time undercut the base of the whole anti-abortion approach. And what I thought was cute about this example is it's tricky enough to defend the right to suicide, because you have to say that's part of supporting your life. It's part of, you see, it is though, because it's part of acting in accordance with your judgment. And to throw in one premise, something that will open up suicide and abortion is a real mind blower from the point of view of laying the context. But what I want to show you is that if you know what you want to get into a letter, and you can state it all briefly, as the rest of this letter was stated. You know that you want to include suicide and abortion. Once you know that, then you should be able to work backward using two criteria. What would I have to establish to lay the basis for this? And how can I put that in such a way that it itself is not controversial. Now, I don't mean that everybody who reads the sentence is going to say, okay, I capitulate. You can't do that. If they read, there are people who could read an encyclopedia and they wouldn't believe anything. So it's not true that however you do it, if you do it right, you're going to win. But what it does mean is that the ordinary, average, rational person who doesn't come as a maniac and just will read a sentence like that and say, yeah, right is a sovereign entity to act according to his judgment. And then when you make the connection, well, then he can get rid of his life if that's his judgment, and it can't apply to an embryo because it's not sovereign. Say, yeah, I never thought of that. And by simply putting together the obvious, it's just not that obvious, it took me 15 minutes to work it out, you can, by setting your context, get away with anything in a letter, or pretty much anything. Now that is a very valuable skill to have. It's partly you have to know the culture to know what kind of thing would be taken as self-contained, and partly you have to know logic to know what principle is really required. And then it's a twofold process. Name what you really need to logically validate the rest, and then see what way you can put it that is not, I'm not saying a concession to public speech, but a way that it will go down and people will be able to understand and accept it. And actually, I think sovereign is a perfect word there. I think I had a question somewhere. Yes.
Yeah, I'm wondering why the word entity, as opposed to say individual or at least being.
It's just a more metaphysical entity. Being could be, the right of a sovereign being would be perfectly all right. I wouldn't want to say a sovereign individual, because then by putting an adjective in front of it, I'm implying that there are individuals who aren't sovereign. See, if you say the black shirt, you're implying there are shirts that aren't black. Now, I can say sovereign entity because entity is so broad, or being is so broad, it can be sovereign and subordinate, etc. But if I say sovereign individual, I'm by implication committing myself to two categories of individuals, and I certainly don't want to suggest anything Nietzschean in a formulation over here. So that's why I wouldn't say individual or person or anything like that. But something metaphysical like entity or being, I just think entity is stronger. And you see, I'm playing on the abortion idea. That's what I want to set up. Now, there's no doubt that the fetus is a being. In other words, something that is. But it is not an entity. It is simply part of another entity. So given my choice, I want to choose the language that will most obviously exclude the embryo and the fetus. So that's a good question. All right, I do want to leave you. Yes, you had one question? Yes.
You wanted to take a shot at animal rights in this letter too. Would that change your opinion?
Yes, I wanted to take a shot at animal rights. I would have to, that you're really getting, you're putting the kitchen sink in. But you'd have to say the right to life is the right of a sovereign, rational entity. You'd have to put that in as incontestable, because that is the attribute of man that entitles him to rights. That makes your premise more complex, but there's no other way of laying the foundation. And that's why it doesn't apply to animals. Animals are entities, but they don't have judgment. They don't have judgment because they don't have cerebration. They just have perceptual reactions. So you need to put rational in. But, we could carry this to the point where you could get all of capitalism from one sentence, but it would be a hell of a long sentence. All right, now I do want to move to number 6. Now, 6 is a fun exercise, but it is an important exercise, and it's the thing you do at the end. There's editing in layers, as Ayn Rand used to say. You don't write an opening sentence and then get it perfect and then go to the next sentence and get it perfect. You spill your guts. You get the whole thing down in a form that's so raw and confused and so on that you would be mortally embarrassed if anyone who knew you saw it. And then you methodically go through. First of all, you want to select what are the points really worth including. We've done that, and we're still going to finish that exercise. And then you want to get a structure. Then you want to try to write it, I haven't given every possible thing here, as clearly as possible, making sure that you set the context where necessary, so it doesn't come across as arbitrary. Then you adjust matters of style and grammar and emotion and tone, etc. And finally, the last thing I do is try to get rid of words. On the grounds of what? What is the principle of epistemology that says reduce? The Crow epistemology. Needless words overload your audience. And the essence of academic writing is to say 25 words when 2 will do. The more you can avoid that, the terser, the more like a telegram you can make it. I have paused for 20 minutes to get rid of a "the," just because if you recast it, I could get the same meaning without of it. And I regard it as an achievement. Every single time a word is out, that is a victory for ease of reading, for clarity, for simplicity. It becomes an end in itself to just squeeze it. And I imagine it like you're just squeezing something that's full of water, and you want to get it just as taut as possible. And I've had to edit 8 times is the normal, simply to get rid of excess verbiage. Now, look now at number 6. So this is a skill I strongly recommend, particularly because you have to write to a requirement of space. They're not going to publish these long letters, and an audience won't sit still for these, interminable pieces. So, it's good practice for you to shorten your letters as much as possible. Not by cutting out important points, although that's one way, but by saying them once. And unless it's deliberately for emphasis, or you haven't got time to write a short letter. Miss Rand used to tell the story of a guy who said, "I'm sorry for writing you such a long letter, but I just didn't have time to write a short one." And there is a total truth in that. Anybody can sit down and just pour out a logorrheic. You know that word logorrheic? It's just what it sounds like. It's like diarrhea with words. Just pour out a logorrheic presentation, saying it over and over and so on, and then say sincerely yours. You can do that without any thought. Thought comes in cutting all that verbiage, figuring out what you really want to say, and then saying it tersely and hitting it on the head. That's what takes time, but that's what makes your letters readable. Now, this, I had great pleasure writing number six, the exercise, because that's how you have to write a doctoral dissertation. And as a matter of fact, it becomes so pernicious that it took me years. I got my doctoral dissertation approved in 1964, and I started the Ominous Parallels in 1968. And during that time, I was pretty much unable to write because I was trying to, the way I think of it, is delouse myself of this academic style, which had become automatic in writing hundreds of pages, and come back into, you know, a style of simple, straightforward English. And I didn't, it took me years to get out of this. And now I can do it as a parody, you know, but, and that's how I did number six. Now, if you read number six, just read it first to yourself. Now, I rewrote that with the identical content in two lines of type, which you will get soon. And the rest of that is all verbiage. But the point is, how do you get rid of verbiage? And the way to do it is pick up your pen and go along with me and strike out or put in parentheses what is needless or repetitive. Sometimes you can cross out five words and two you'll think of will do it. And just go through and see what's left. Now I'll show you the process. We just don't have the time for me to ask you to list every word in order, but the vast majority are unnecessary. Sheer, let's start from the beginning. Sheer is unnecessary. The quantity is enough. Separate is unnecessary. Obviously, we're not talking about them together. Becomes at a certain point and under certain conditions. Well, what are you going to do with that? You certainly don't need both of them. The conditions occur at a point, and the point involves conditions. So something has to go. At the minimum, let's kill under certain conditions, because it's bigger words. Problematical and even excessive. Now, that is a typical thing. If you're speaking, you could say it's a problem. It's even too much. But in writing, there is never an excuse for putting something down and saying, you know, I thought better of it. And then something else is really the truth. So whenever you've got problematical and even excessive, kill off problematical and even, because excessive is the one he was aiming at. You must never think aloud when you're writing. In your first draft, that's okay. But then you've got to come back and say, well, what do I mean? Now let's look back at what we've got. The quantity of units becomes, at a certain point, excessive. Now that is sometimes valuable as a way of saying, I'm going to say the same thing in other words and thereby cast a new light on this situation. But that is also a way, if you don't use it properly, of stating something over again because you don't like the way you stated it the first time. And then you just throw two different things at the reader and say, you pick, I can't. That is unacceptable. Now we've got to it. That is intolerably burdensome. It's, in other words, what? It's too much. It's excessive. So, out. Now, do we believe in a collective consciousness? Then we don't need individual consciousness. No modifiers unless it's in contrast, so we can call out to the individual. So now we have the quantity of units becomes at a certain point excessive to, all right, to the consciousness. What is the consciousness doing? What is the obvious thing we can get rid of right away? If it's excessive, what do we know about the odds? It's obviously daunting odds. It's too much to be done. So out goes against daunting odds. Now, this consciousness is doing what? Struggling to retain a multiplicity of units. What have we just said? Did we just say there was one unit? We said the quantity of units becomes excessive. So what are we adding by saying, you know, it's really hard to struggle against a multiplicity of units. We're saying the same thing again in another word, and just raising in the reader's mind, is this multiplicity the same as the excessive quantity from before? Or he says, such a multiplicity, you mean it's something like that, but it's not that? By taking a simple idea and restating it in different language, you just raise havoc in a person's reading. I remember once talking to Miss Rand about writing dialogue, and I had a teacher who said, you shouldn't overuse said. You know, he said, she said, he said, she said. You should. He told us, this is in Canada, so you know, inferior schooling, but he told us, exploit the resources of the language. Say, like, I love you, he said. Do you, she asseverated. Yes, he affirmed, you know. And I asked Miss Rand what she thought of that, and she just, she had a very definite negative view of that. And she said, all you do is utterly confuse the reader, because if all you want to do is say he said, she said, the simplest and most unobtrusive thing to do is to say you said over and over. If you're going to say asseverated, imploded, explicated, interjected, etc., then the reader thinks, well, there must be some reason why you didn't just say it. They lose sight totally of the dialogue, and you've got all these useless variations of saying. And I never forgot that. She said, it is not a virtue to use different words for the same idea in the same paragraph or the same passage. It simply confuses the reader. Ideally, you structure your grammar so you don't need to repeat, but if it comes up that you have to say it again, or use a pronoun. Don't find a way, it's excessive, it's a multiplicity, it's overloaded, it's etc., etc. All of that just raises questions. So let's kill off multiplicity. So we can kill off multiplicity of units. Now we've got within the forefront or focus. Well, there again, you have to always watch ORs. Now, I had a separate editing on OPAR for ORs. And there's a lot of times when you write where no matter how you try, you're going to find you just can't decide whether it's the forefront or the focus. And one is, you know, the spatial metaphor, and the other is the energy. And you can't pick which it is. So you let yourself get away with two, no matter how strict you are. Well, when you have an editing for oars, which I had, you go through and you say, I'm going to commit to getting rid of the oars. I mean, this kind of oar. This oar of indecision. So which is it, the forefront or focus? Well, obviously, forefront is a spatial metaphor. And focus is the exact psychological term. So kill off forefront. Within the focus. Now, of its cognitive field, well, do I need a horrible mouthful like cognitive field? What about if I just said within its focus? Obviously, it's trying to acquire knowledge, but I don't have to give the pedigree of the history and the hobbies of this consciousness. All I'm trying to say is there's only so much you can keep within its focus. So whenever I've got an ugly phrase like of its cognitive field, let's just make it within its focus. Now, here we got a sentence. The preceding one said, in effect, that the quantity of units becomes excessive to the consciousness. Now, to the consciousness struggling, we have no struggle, right? The only reason it struggles is because they're excessive, which we've already said. So let's kill off struggling. Now we've got the quantity of units becomes at a certain point excessive to the consciousness. And somewhere we want to get in the idea that we really mean it can't hold it within its focus, because if we didn't put that in, we would be missing an important qualification. If all I said is, you can only hold so many units, what would the immediate thought be? You're mentally retarded, or, you know, your mental capacity could take in 20 units and that's all. So it's essential to the thought that you can only hold so many units in the focus at a given time. So we can't throw that out. We can't yet build it into the grammar, but that's a key thought. Now, here we have. The result is the unavoidable evaporation of most or all of the units. Notice the ludicrous attempt at precision. Most or all. Why do we need that? We don't need that. Now, the result is the evaporation. The result of what? Of giving it too much. What is too much? More than it can hold. Well, if it can't hold it, what's going to happen? It's going to lose it, right? So this is still another way of saying what? Too many units. We already said there's too many units. Now, by putting it in the cast of the result, it's like cause and effect. But it isn't cause and effect, it's just the same thing over again. There's too many units to hold. Result, you can't hold them. Well, I mean, you know, the only way I get around it is by using words like evaporation instead of hold. So you think, oh, that must be something new. But then we can cross off this whole part. The result is the unavoidable evaporation of the mind in question. That is. So now we know he's not even satisfied with that statement. Having stated it over, he's got to tell us that one again. In other words, we're talking about the inability of the thus overloaded consciousness. Why is it overloaded? It's too many units, right? So we've already said that. And it can't sustain its all-encompassing grasp. Why not? Too many to hold, right? Within the confines of a single frame of its awareness. Well, we just said within its focus, which is shorter than within the confines of a single frame of awareness. So that's out. And it can't keep the consciousness of all the individually involved separate units. Now, individually involved means separate, and separate we've already said, and units we've already said, so that's all out. So what is the total content of the whole thing? There's a quantity of units which becomes too much to keep in focus. Now, who could say that in English, in simple English? This is, yes.
The mind can hold only so many units in focus at once.
That's good. Or I put it this way, mine is even wordier than yours. There are only a certain number of units which a consciousness can hold within its focus at any given time. That's basically what you said. That's it. The entire first paragraph comes down to there's only a certain number of units that your consciousness can hold within its focus at any given time. That's it. All the rest of this is repetition, metaphors, rewording, big terms, and it, you know, if you don't know what's going on, you could read that and say, well, this guy certainly seems to know what he's talking about. But he entirely loses the idea. If you write like this, it's not simply that it's bad stylistically and that the reader will just throw up his hands in horror if he's not a Kantian. It's that the writer does not know what his thought is. He does not know what he's actually saying. If it stood in his mind as, there's only so many units I can focus on, he would write it that way. If he writes it this way, it means it's some hash that he got out of a lecture, plus uncertainty, plus he remembers how Miss Rand put certain things, plus he likes big words. But ideally, if you understand something, you should be able to have 3 martinis, go to sleep, then have someone tap you on the shoulder, and you, the instant you open your eyes, he says, give me the co-epistemologist. There's only a certain number. You give it right off. But you can't possibly pass that test if you hold it in mind as the sheer quantity of separate units becomes a certain. You just can't do it. Now let's look at the bottom paragraph. The above, though needlessly pedantic in its mode of expression. Well, what can we get rid of there? We've got rid of the needless pedantry, so instead of apologizing for it, we'll just delete it. One general rule of good writing: don't do something wrong and then apologize for it. Never apologize. How many people give speeches and say, I only have an hour, I can only do 5 points. I know that there's 13 points I should cover, but I can only do 5. This is, now they think in their own deluded fashion that they're being honest with the audience and that they're covering the bases, so if anybody knows the other 8 points, they know, I know it too, I just couldn't get to it. But in fact, that is utterly useless. Anybody that expects you to do the 13 points in an hour is not worthy of consideration, because it means they have no idea what time it takes to present a point. But for the ordinary audience member, the question is, if these points are important enough to tell us that she's not covering them or that he's not covering them, why not give an indication of what they are? Otherwise, it's taken for granted that no matter how many points you make, there's 400 more points you could have made. So don't tell the audience that. Don't come out defensively with, I can only do 5 points. Now, every once in a while, that will come out inadvertently, just you can't help yourself. But try, especially in writing, not to apologize. Don't commit the sin, and then don't apologize for it. So don't write pedantically and then say, this is needlessly pedantic. Just cut it all out, the pedantry and the explanation. All right, so the above is the ultimate and even definitive meaning. Now, ultimate and even definitive, what do you do with that? Well, if it's not, ultimate means last. So we definitely don't want that. It means what you would reach after extensive exploration, the ultimate. But we're just giving a sentence here. So it's ridiculous to say this is the ultimate. So get rid of that. The definitive meaning. Well, if it's the meaning, that's the definition. If it's not definitive, you didn't give the meaning. So get rid of definitive. Now, of what objectivists are wont to call. Now that is just typical phony prose. Why not just what they call? Why is it they have to wont to call? That's ridiculous. And now, in somewhat jocular fashion, I mean, if we have to include in a definition of an epistemological principle, by the way, this is a joke, that's ridiculous, so that has to go. So what does it actually say? The above, well, we don't need above anymore because it's just one sentence. So we can change above to this. This is what? This is what objectivists call the crow epistemology. That's all it says. This is what objectivists call the crow epistemology. That's it. So the whole hundreds of words come down to. There are only a certain number of units which a consciousness can hold within its focus at any given time. This is what objectivists call the crow epistemology. That's it. That's two lines of type as against an entire page. Well, I've got it in double space, but as against how many? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. It's reduced to 1/4. And it's, is it not infinitely clear? And do you also see that it takes a lot more work to do it? Because this kind of thing, anybody can sit down, the long version, and babble on and on, because you don't have to say, have I said this, have I not said this, is this a new angle, is this the right word? It just spews out. This is what I suggest you do in a very rigorous way with your own writing. Now, you will probably err at the beginning if you take this seriously of cutting out, you know, the bone along with the fat. So you have to know when a phrase is essential. For instance, in this case, you could easily have cut out hold within its focus. And if you had left that out, your sentence would have read, there's only a certain number of units which a consciousness can hold. And that, as I say, would suggest a metaphysical retardation. We can't get to all the units there are in the universe. There's only 8 that are up to us. But when we say can hold within its focus at a given time, we're very clearly talking about the mechanics and not the metaphysical incapacity of the phenomenon. So I'm not saying every clarifying phrase is just gibberish and throw it out. I'm saying it has to hold its own. You have to be able to justify all those phrases by seeing that if they were omitted, the meaning would be substantially altered, would be unclear, would give rise to other possibilities. But within the limits of doing that, in other words, don't cut out the bone. Within the limits of doing that, the more you can cut, every word that you can cut is a benefit. It's a benefit to clarity. It's a benefit to your own understanding. It's a benefit to the reader being able to take it in, and it's a benefit to getting it published. Because the shorter it is, the more likely it's going to get published, other things being equal. Now, do I have any questions just on the sheer, this issue of condensation? Because I regard this as an important topic. It's not, you know, life and death the way you have to select your points and structure them. But it is important in the sense that it's like if you did a painting and you figured out exactly what objects you're going to put and you worked out your composition, and then you just stood across the room and hurled paint indiscriminately at the canvas on the grounds of, well, you know, you want to cover it up. That's what this is. This is like taking a bucket of words and just tossing it. It just completely obliterates any structure or content that you had. So don't always remember that line that would always help me, that I quoted already. Take the time to write it short. Don't ever submit anything because you didn't have time to make it short enough. And I think you'll find that a very helpful as an adjunct to clear thinking. I know that in doing The objective of the OPAR book, of course, I learned a great deal by thinking about each chapter, what points should be included, what logical structure, and so on. But even on the eighth editing, I was still trying to decide, that, for instance, forefront or focus, is this a metaphor? Which is the literal thing? What am I actually saying here? And every time I made an editorial change or cut out a word, it was like a little tiny glimmer of added clarity. You know, I could really see this point now. And I can't oversell the importance of condensation. So long as you're not cutting content, that really counts. Did I have any questions on this point? Yes?
Are there cases when you can use in that, or that is, like saying individual rights, i.e. the right?
Absolutely. I use i.e. or that is all the time. But when I want to go from one formulation to a different one, and I want the IE to signify to you, the reader, this is going to be two different phrases, but I am saying this is really this. So, for instance, existence is identity, IE, there is no nothing. Now, there is no nothing doesn't sound like existence is identity, but I'm trying using it as a shorthand way of saying this follows from that. And it's a very value. I'm glad you asked that. I couldn't even write without IE, because it's a shorthand way, and you can string a whole, this means this, IE this, IE this, IE this. And if you watch any of the ones that I do in OPAR, you'll see that when I get to the end of the chain, if you read just the last item with the first item, there's no relationship at all that you can see. But each one takes the argument one step further, and it's a continuous reformulating, but in order to demonstrate a logical relationship, you see. It's not a reformulating because I was unhappy with the first one. If I'm unhappy, then I just get rid of it and say it the one way. So that certainly is a good question. Was there any others on this? Yes?
I was going to ask, in the last writing that I did years ago in college, I found that I could over-condense. That is, I would write something obviously verbose, I'd go through it and start cutting, and I'd then look at the result and realize that I had taken out the meat, the reality, the concreteness of it, and I ended up with something that sounded too abstract, too unconvincing.
Well,
how can I balance this?
You have to balance, but I think your problem is contained in your question. A concrete is not needless verbiage. The goal of condensation is not to eliminate concretes and have just floating abstractions. Very often, in order to communicate an abstract point, you must give examples. For instance, we could have had our motivation on justice a lot simpler if we just walked in and said, some people use justice to mean selfish, and some people use it to mean unselfish. Some people pit it against need, and others don't. What do you think? And the class would just look at you, they don't know what you're talking about. The examples are of the essence. So, it's a Platonist idea that in order to get rid of useless verbiage, sacrifice all concretes. By the same token, it's a Humean idea that you should give only concretes and sacrifice abstractions because they're just hot air in the way we use words and it's all arbitrary. You want to keep a balance within your writing, always keeping both levels going so that any abstractions you use have an example if it's necessary to your audience and vice versa. And that is part of the meat. Do not equate meat with abstraction, otherwise you're going to just get you'll get kind of an abstruse telegram as a result, which will be useless. Yes?
Well, giving a speech, obviously you don't need to prepare to talk to that to the audience. My question is, how about just everyday life? You're just talking with people who you work with. Do you prepare for those kind of things just come up spontaneously? Someone might say something about the antitrust laws,
Do I prepare for ordinary conversation?
I mean, in these situations where someone just comes up and you want to be able to just engage them, I mean, I'm thinking this in terms of an individual one-to-one basis with people you just bump up against in your everyday life that you want to actually confront with this.
Well, it's impossible. First of all, let's make a big distinction here between writing and speaking. What I'm talking about in writing, it is impossible to condense in speaking unless you are a fantastic speaker with many decades of experience. Because, first of all, if you did condense so perfectly as you do in writing, it would miss your audience in speaking. I have taken passages from one of my books that I thought had, you know, this is just as clear as it could get, and read it to an intelligent class, and I could tell, you know, being a good teacher, I could tell it went right over their head totally. And they had the context and everything, but I could realize the pace is just too fast. It's so condensed that they have to take in every word and they can't do it by listening. So you have to relax your pace in speaking. And you'll find, if you took it, you don't find me terribly verbose right now, I hope. But if you took a transcript of this class, a written transcript, you would find so much repetition, so many ways of saying the same thing. Look, I just did it, see? Which I'm doing that deliberately for emphasis because I know you can't take it in on one shot. When I was young, I had the illusion, well, it's easy to remain in print. You just give a talk and let somebody type it up. But it's utterly useless. What you end up with is a shambles of disorganization and repetition, and you have to rewrite the whole thing anyway. So there is an application to speaking, which is, you know, modestly, don't keep hammering the same thing over and over if he gets it. But there's a lot of stumbling when you speak. There's a lot of starting and thinking, well, this is not the way that, you know, you're in mid-action now. In writing, you have as much time as you want to write it and condense it and reorganize it and perfect it. That's why I believe writing is an infinitely superior medium to talking. I think that before mankind reached writing, when they were only able to speak, they were really unable. They hadn't the concept of precision and clarity that writing makes possible. Speaking as basically approximation. You circle around a thing, you try to get it through, and you use one word and then another word, and basically when the other person nods and says, aha, you stop. So don't apply these standards in that rigorous way to ordinary conversation. The only application of condensation is if you know you're just saying the same thing over and over. Probably the reason you're doing it is you can't think of a better way to put it. So just file it in your mind as I'm missing something here. Now, the only way I ever learned to handle conversations like that is repetition. You know, I've been doing it since, I'm afraid even to tell you, but it's a long, long, long time. And there's only so many questions. I asked Miss Rand once, how do you always know the answer? She said, because they always ask the same question. And basically that's true. Maybe once in 2 years someone will say a question, gee, I never thought of that one. But usually, you know, it's the standard questions, and you could, I don't have the number, but it's more or less like 37A, 12F, 6G, and then, you know, you just start your mouth and your mind goes somewhere else while your mouth is delivering that number. Now that you get basically from experience, and the best way to do it, what I always used to do in the early years, I would always go home with a sense of what a terrible answer I gave, whether it was arguing with kids in class, my fellow students, or answering students. I always felt I didn't say it right, I didn't get the essential, I know I was baffled. And I did this, I give myself this credit, I did this even when the other person said, I agree and you've convinced me. If I felt in my own mind I really wasn't clear, then that would obsess me how to do it. you know, how to get it straight in my mind. Very often I would go to Ms. Rand and say, I was asked this and I answered this and there's something wrong with I don't know what. And then of course she would give me a 2-hour analysis of what was wrong with the whole question and the answer and the approach and everything. But it took a long, long time. And then of course you'd get one question straight and no one would ever ask it again for 3 years and you'd keep. But finally, the same is true if you give a class. If there's some one point that you're not satisfied with, it sticks in my mind, you know, like a sore tooth, you know, where you can't take your tongue away and you have to keep poking it. Well, if I feel like in process that I'm saying something that I'm not really clear about, but I can't stop the class and say, sorry, I'm not clear, it's like it sticks there. And as I'm going, you know, back to the room or when I wake up tonight or whatever on the plane, it'll just keep coming back until finally I'll straighten it out. And that's the only way that you can basically prepare for conversations. The part you know, and the part that you're unclear, you have to detect. It does not affect, you can get a standing ovation and think it was a terrible lecture, and you have to take your opinion over there, you know. And vice versa, they can think it's a bad lecture, you think it was good, that's too bad too. But you have to have very, very strong standards for your own inner clarity. The standard has to be, do I really get this point? Not, did I make it clear to him or these stupid people? Not that I think of you that way, but not, did I make it clear to them, but do I get it? Because if I get it, I know I can make it clear. And when something is obscure, confusing, it rings an alarm bell. And it always did. Now, of course, in my early years, it was just like a continuous succession of alarms. You know, like the whole city was burning down all the time. But after a while, you get it, you know, under control. So that's what I would suggest as a method. But don't expect, if you could possibly take this attitude, if you get all confused in a conversation, instead of thinking, oh my God, I let down objectivism, I look like a fool, etc., think, great. I now see an area that I really don't know what I'm talking about, so I have something to think about. And there's a lot more written than in my day, you know, which in my earliest day, there was only the Fountainhead to read. So you've got books and lectures, you know, etc. So you should look at it as good if you found something unclear. Better to find it now, and then when you go on national television, you know, 10 years from now, you'll know it. Then that it never comes up now, and it comes up on national television in 10 years, you think, oh my God, I never thought of this. The more confusion, and the more you clarify your confusion, the more it helps to clarify other things. Because everything is interconnected, and it's like you get one part of the picture in focus, and it makes it easier to see what's confusing about another part. So, don't be threatened by confusion. I've said many times, I'm sorry, I do not know. I even once had the temerity to tell that to a class the first day that I was ever teaching in 1957. And I just knew the subject enough to have read the lesson for that day, but I hadn't read to the next lesson. And somebody asked a question from later in the book. And I said, you know, I have to be very frank with you. I don't know this subject, although I'm teaching it. And I only got up to page 8. So, you know, I'll give it to you when we get there. And I made a note, and I did. And they don't hold it against you. Students do not. Nobody expects you to know everything. No, today, nobody expects you to know anything. All right, now, we got a half an hour, but we have taken some of your questions, so I don't feel that same sense of dereliction. I have a couple of volunteers, if we have time, to turn to question 1. Now, just to remind you, this is on selectivity, and we cut out a number of possibilities. I will tell you what I basically cut out. I cut out money grubbing. I think we did that in class, didn't we? And I cut out greed as being synonymous. I said to myself about cartels, in this context, it doesn't raise anything different than lobbies, and it's too complicated to go into, so I'm going to let it go. But I found a way of injecting it just as a little tiny parenthesis. And the UN, a side issue, I wouldn't even dream of touching it. More laws. No, sir, because they want more laws because they think they have this problem. If I get rid of the problem, the laws fall on their own. Instincts, too complicated. Out. So I ended up that there really were two crucial things, and that's it. And what are the two crucial things that I felt are absolutely indispensable to answer this letter in essential terms? Just volunteer. Two sentences you gotta make. Well, I guess I put that in too intimidating a way. Yeah, give me one.
Lobbies are impossible under capitalism.
One is disconnect lobbies from capitalism. Now, this guy sees, so it seems to be a blatant phenomenon. These lobbies are all there with their hands out. They seem to be an epitome of selfishness, and they're under so-called capitalism. Now, that is not a dishonest observation. It's a disastrous, but that is the heart of his claim. Capitalism is too selfish because look at all the lobbies. So you absolutely have got to dissociate lobbies from capitalism. Now you have two different ways of doing that. What are they? One is you can say where lobbies come from and show that that's really the opposite. Or the other is to tell us what capitalism is and then show us why it couldn't possibly lead to lobbies. Now, I did both. That's my letter. That's it. Now, but before I hand out mine, I want to hear, I had two volunteers. Bennett, do you want to just come sit in that chair? Now, we're taking for granted you have how many words?
191,
okay. Just let me get a piece of paper so I can make a comment here. Okay.
Lobbies and cartels are characteristics not of capitalism, but of mixed economies, and thus cannot be a basis for attacking capitalism. Capitalism is a system of freedom, in which the government is the protector of individual rights, not their chief violator. Lobbies rise under a mixture of freedoms and controls as pressure groups seek special favors from the government. Cartels such as OPEC are impotent under capitalism. They succeed only because the government controls the energy prices and restrictions on production. Capitalism is a system of selfishness, rational selfishness, and that is its virtue. Selfishness means acting in one's own interests and requirements of life. Selfishness demands reason. Since the interests of rational men don't conflict, the notion of too much selfishness is absurd. Man is not born between some higher dimension and a default of lower nature. He has volition, not instincts. His actions are products of thought, of his faculty of reason. In a rational man, thought and action are integrated, both pertain to this world. We don't need strict laws. We need limited government free of economic controls. What we need is capitalism.
Now, you did an excellent job there. It's very hard for us to comment by just listening because I can't take enough notes to keep up with you. But judging from what you said, it did have a good inner logic and flow, and you covered a lot more points than I tried to. I was deliberately following the SEAL activity format, so I restricted myself. There's two types of letter you could write. You could try to briefly cut through everything, or you could take a few points and try to develop them. And I took the latter approach, so it's good for people to see both, because sometimes what you want to do is try to be a little more persuasive on a couple of points, and your continuous choice in writing this type of letter is, you got 2 points. Should I give one sentence to each point, which I can connect and make coherent? Or should I give one sentence to big point and then one or two follow-up sentences to nail it home? And at the price of dropping the second point. Now, I made the deliberate decision. I want to get a lot of philosophic propaganda in here. So rather than let them pick every point and try to navigate it all, I'm going to make only a couple of points. What are lobbies? Where do they come from? What is capitalism? And that's it. But each try to develop to a paragraph so that together it would make a more powerful but more limited case, you see. So it's entirely an option, as long as what you say doesn't come across as just a series of, arbitrary claims, which it didn't. It sounded very reasonable and forthright and right on the point. So I think you did an excellent job. Now, Betsy, you wanted to try. How many words is yours? You said 118?
116.
116. Now, that's already, getting shorter than you have to, but let's see what you could do. But if you've left out something important and it's 116, you leave yourself vulnerable because we said you had 84 more words. Now, not too fast, because it's hard to take this in orally.
Your editorial is based on a questionable assumption that selfishness is evil. Many observe the wealth and well-being flowing from the selfish capitalism you condemn and question that assumption. Millions in Eastern Europe are rejecting the misery that came with the selfless sacrifice for the collective and the government restraints on selfishness you recommend. They question your assumption. Lifetime reviews surveyed by the Library of Congress consider the influence of arch-egoist Ayn Rand on their lives second only to the Bible. Rand's Atlas Shrugged is famous for its proud, productive, rational, and inspiring heroes who are the embodiment of selfishness. Not everyone believes selfishness is evil. Many who value human accomplishment and happiness actually do question your assumptions.
Thank you, Betsy. Now, you could have used your 86 words because you omitted one point that is really, you selected down to one topic, which is selfishness. Now, obviously, philosophically, that is the most important point in the piece. They're denouncing capitalism for being selfish. But they gave one crucial thing as the evidence, something that everybody doesn't like and that on the face of it is selfish. And that was the lobbying. By omitting that entirely, you leave the question up in the air because it's like you're saying, you don't like selfishness, I like selfishness, and here's all the good things, etc. But you leave open the question, well then, this kind of war among lobbies is part of the system and you're in favor of it. Since you don't challenge it, don't even say in parentheses, lobbies are bad, they're not really capitalism, they're not really selfish, etc. You just ignore it altogether. And since that's the essence of his case, you leave yourself in a position that if a reader reads the editorial and reads yours, it's like they have to choose between capitalism, which is selfish and has a lot of corrupt things because of it, or Eastern European and unselfish systems, which are also no good, so it's hopeless. There's no place to go. Now, whereas Bennett did enough to disassociate lobbies, you see, you have to draw the line on where you can't do the UN and every little thing in it. But the whole heart of the argument that is presented is, look at lobbies. Everybody hates lobbies. If lobbies aren't selfish, what the hell is? They all put their hands out and say, gimme, gimme, gimme. And this is certainly a capitalism, isn't it? So then what you have to say is basically what he said, this isn't capitalism. See, that isn't a capitalistic phenomenon. Well, where does it come from then? What would capitalism be? So you're into a different... Now I have to give you the one... positive that you included, which is you got a lot of good propaganda in. And that's always to the good. If you can mention Ayn Rand's works and about, you know, her novels, etc., and get someone to read it that way, that is always to the good. But that is extracurricular right now. We want to know, strictly in logic, have we given an answer or not? Now, have I got these scholars or whoever they are? Would you now distribute the page that says answers 1, 4, and 6? And when you get it, would you read number 1? Did everybody get to read that? Now, did you see what my strategy is in writing this as I did? Do you want another minute just to... Did you change it?
Yeah.
Okay. Do you want another minute to finish it, or are you with me? Okay. I decided that I've got to break apart this connection between lobbies and capitalism. Lobbies and selfishness, lobbies and capitalism. That's the horrible package. And that's going to require me to say where lobbies come from and then how capitalism would work by contrast. And then I just have a mop-up paragraph. So my first paragraph starts, is very much like yours, Bennett, our first sentence, I believe. Contrary to your editorial, lobbies in Washington are not an expression of selfishness or capitalism, but of today's semi-socialist mixed economy. Now that's the important thing. That's my topic right off the bat. And in a letter, there's no motivation and there's no long intros. If the thing you want to say is, lobbies are not selfish and they're not capitalism, start right up. Say, lobbies are not an expression of selfishness or capitalism, but of today's semi-socialist mixed economy. Now, in a really, really, really brief letter, you could stop and say sincerely, but then it's just a claim. I don't know what capitalism is, and on the face of it, why would a mixed economy lead to lobbies? So what I want to do, since I've given myself the space because I'm throwing out all the little things that I'm not going to get to, I want to give some logic to why lobbies would arise in this kind of mixed economy. Now, this is not going to be a treatise that is going to convert any reader. It's going to be what a letter can be, and that's all it can be. A suggestion of a line of thought, a line of developing an idea, and an interested reader can say, yeah, I never thought of that possibility. And any honest reader knows that it's impossible to make your full case in a letter. So what you're trying to do is suggest a line of thought rather than, and I prefer that, take a couple of main points and develop them. Not develop them the way I would in a class, but in the sense of an indication of pointing to the next steps so they get the idea of a framework of argument rather than a bunch of little points that I answer one after the other. So I go on to, well, why? How will I point out to them that it's mixed economy is the thing behind lobbies? Well, I want to show what happens. You can't really have private ownership or complete liberty under today's system. Now that should be understandable because I've called it a semi-socialist. And that invokes the idea of the government is there and the government tells you what to do with your property and the government tells you what you can and can't do. So you don't have the kind of prerogatives, control, and liberty that you would have under a pure capitalist system. And then it becomes plausible. Not convincing, but you can be convincing in a letter, but it becomes plausible as a step in a direction. Well, what are we going to do? The state has all this power. By myself, I'm helpless. I'll have to get together with others and get from them what I can't get on my own. And thus the genesis of lobbies, which I call gangs. By calling them gangs, I reduce it to a phenomenon throughout history of helpless individuals join gangs, and I say my opinion of lobbies at the same time, that they're no more than gangs. Now, if I just say that much and stop there, I think to myself, well, that is really pretty theoretical. I mean, it holds as a suggestion. But I'd like to say one more thing, only I don't want this to be another theoretical argument. Could I get something out of the horse's mouth itself that would carry along my same point so that even the lobbyists themselves are showing out of their own mouth? So I say, observe that the spokesmen of these gangs reject pure capitalism, and everyone acknowledges, you know, businessmen don't want pure capitalism, labor doesn't want pure capitalism, farmers don't want, they're all against capitalism, and they all denounce selfishness. No farmer ever said, I want parity prices because I want to take a trip to the Caribbean. It's always because the service to the nation, the preservation of agriculture, the public good, etc. So I have out of the, I have like an empirical confirmation of my theory. I said in theory, if you have a mixed system, people are going to huddle in gangs because they don't have the freedom to function. And look at them. They themselves say, we don't want freedom, and we're doing it unselfishly. So on the negative side, I've done what I can to dissociate lobbies from selfish individual action and from capitalism. I'm saying it comes from another system with another motivation, so I've got a good beginning. But so far, if I just stopped sincerely there, the answer would be, well, capitalism is then a total blank. If what we have is not capitalism, what would capitalism be? Now, I don't have to say that. But he's given me such an opening when he says capitalism is too selfish. And then he's given an unselfish phenomenon that doesn't belong to capitalism as an example of it. It's simply irresistible as propaganda and as logic to say, now let's see what capitalism is, and you'll see from another aspect that it's the exact opposite of law. So then I say, by contrast, capitalism. Now, I stuck in the original American system is pure propaganda. To associate, to tie into the positive connotations of the original American, the pro-American idea. It also, though, is helpful as identifying what do you mean. I mean the system we had when the country was founded. And then be sure there's no unclarity because, you know, capitalism is used in so many ways. I say the complete separation of state and economics. That's a good definition to use in a letter. Now, it's not good in a treatise on economics. You want to go into private property and rights and the whole business. But for a short, terse statement in a letter where capitalism is key and a distortion is being put forth to the effect that today's mixed economy is capitalism, it's almost incumbent upon you to say something about what you mean by capitalism. Otherwise, they won't get your meaning. Now I want to say capitalism is selfish. And that is its glory, because his idea, the editorialist writer, was capitalism is too selfish. It leads to all these bad things, so that's the flaw. So I have to counter that head on. I can't just say capitalism is selfish and leave the implication whether I like it or not. I want to say capitalism is selfish and terrific. That's the way it ought to be. It's not like this crummy mixed economy where these people go into gangs and promise unselfishness. So I've got to take the bull by the horns and say it is selfish and that's its glory. Now how am I going to validate the desirability of selfishness? That's a mammoth proposition. And I'm already late in my letter. And the idea that occurs to me is I'm going to have to do it through individual rights, ending up with a definition of sacrifice, of selfishness, that'll make it self-evidently desirable, but working through what I can count on in the culture, which is individual rights. So I say, capitalism needs a society which protects individual rights. Now, they all know individual rights. This leaves each man free to pursue his own happiness. They recognize freedom, you know, the right to the pursuit of happiness. And it leaves him free, so I'm already associating freedom with rights, and create his own property independently by means of his own work and thought without government favors. So I've completely contrasted it with these people whose hands are tied and bound and have to huddle in groups and beg for help because they don't have the freedom to function. In this system, they are free to function, and therefore they can create property by their own work without government favors. And now I'm ready to say, since they're doing it independently, by their own work, nobody suffers. They don't sacrifice anybody else to them, nor vice versa. So I've got in now the full definition of selfishness. You pursue your own happiness, you do the work independently, you don't get favors, you don't sacrifice. By this point of the game, selfishness emerges as something obviously desirable. We've eliminated all of the confusion so far as you can in a brief letter. And now I've shot my shoot. Lobbies come from the opposite, and this is how they say it themselves. Capitalism is selfish, and this is how it works, and isn't that great? And now all I want to do is just cash into the final conclusion. We don't need laws to, quote, control man's instincts. Now, by putting control man's instincts in quotes, I'm disowning it. You know, that's the kind of quote you're saying. That's the kind of words you use, not me. We need laissez-faire capitalism based on a rational philosophy which teaches men to cherish rational self-interest. This is pure propaganda. I'm allowed to say rational because I've said he creates his property by his own work and thought. So I've laid a basis for rational. And its corollaries of liberty, I've covered that, and personal responsibility, I've covered that, because I've said he creates his property independently. Well, now, if men are personally responsible, and they have to function as individuals, obviously then, lobbies are out. And then, just throw away in parentheses, so are cartels for that matter, but who cares by now? They've completely been shunted over, hopefully, onto the right side. Now that's 188 words. That could be condensed, but I figured, you know, since I gave you 200, I would take 200 myself. But as you see from the other letters, there are many different options here. The method is always strip it down to essentials. Decide, and the method I like is to take a few essentials and give a sentence or two elaboration pointing in the direction of an argument so that your letter as a whole has a coherence and adds up to not just you were wrong on point A, B, C, D, E, but rather there's a whole other philosophy that you don't get, and here's the contours of it, and if a reader is interested, they know how to think thereafter. That's what I would do with a letter. Now, as I say, I do not hold that up as the greatest letter ever written in history, but just as one way that I think is helpful in answering the assignment. Now, we have a couple of minutes for general questions about writing as such. Yes?
When you're using regarding adjectives, if you have a word that's very confused in the culture, the essence of the meaning is not very well understood, and you want to bring out the essence by using an adjective,
yeah,
at the expense of trying to imply that there are other types of...
You can do it. You mean like individual rights or laissez-faire capitalism?
Or I use monopolistic cartels. Does that be a...
Well, I think cartel pretty much includes monopolistic as part of it.
That's an example, but...
But, for instance, laissez-faire capitalism should not be written, because there is no other kind of capitalism. But there are words today which are so badly abused that for purposes of brief communication, if you just said capitalism, they'll take it the way the editorial did, that it means what we have today. So it's like a cue. I really mean capitalism. And the same is true for individual rights. There's no collective rights. But there are so many people that talk about collective rights that you want to disown yourself. That is a problem. And there's no way around that in a brief writing. But to put in a superfluous adjective because of the cultural context. And you just do it when you can't avoid it. Yes?
Editors will often edit the letters to the editor. And I've had my letters edited. And do you have any suggestions on how to... Are there certain things you can do to avoid them really botching up?
No. The only thing you can do to avoid them botching your letter is put P.S. Please print in full or not at all. But then you run the risk that they just won't print it. It depends what you're inured to. I am so used across the years to being horrendously misquoted that if anything remotely plausible survives, I consider it to the good. The older I get, the more I incline to what I used to think was monstrous. Namely, as long as they spell your name correctly, it doesn't make any difference what they say. So you're completely at the mercy of the editor, but I wouldn't let that stop you, because some editors actually improve your letter by cutting out superfluous language or fixing up your grammar. It's not common for letters to the editor to try to botch what you're doing. It may just be that they don't know what your point is and they think it's too wordy. But I would take the chance. I'm going to go on a minute or two longer. Oh, we didn't even have a break, did we?
No.
Well, you want to take the break here and end the lecture? I forgot the break altogether. I'm sorry. What I know that was supposed to... We didn't have a break, did we? Well, we'll definitely have one on Thursday. Betsy, I'm going to appoint you in charge of the break, okay? So at some point, you have to jump up like Cyrano and say, this is it. All right, let's take one more question then, and that'll be... instead of going 5 minutes over long, that'll be your break. Yes?
He was talking about picturing a reader in this culture.
Yeah.
You know, I try to picture basically a rational person. But if you go into college using the word rational, if you really say it explicitly, it's not an attractive thing anymore. So could you kind of talk about who are you writing for? Who should you have in mind as a reader?
Well, the simplest answer to that is you write for yourself when you were young. You can only basically write for yourself. If I write to freshmen or talk to freshmen, I say the kind of things that I would have been able to follow or the kind of confusions I would have needed addressed, etc. If I write to PhDs, I just project what I knew at that stage of the game and what I didn't know. It's impossible to me to just project a reader of whom I know nothing, because I don't know how to assess his knowledge. You try to define within the limits possible to you. Does he know objectivism or not? Does he know philosophy or not? And that will guide you. But just to say he's rational gives you really the information that you don't have to be demagogic, and he'll listen to an argument, but it won't tell you what level of argument to pitch it at. And to me, the single most valuable thing is if you are introspectively aware of the stages you've gone through as you develop, you address yourself at an earlier stage. I always write for myself, argue for myself, and write a lecture for myself, but as I project what I would want if I didn't know this topic. And I really think that's about the best you can do. Ladies and gentlemen, I abjectly apologize for forcing you to sit through 2 hours. And I will try to make up for it by having an extra minute break on Thursday.